Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. Today, we true crime folks have no trouble believing women are capable of all kinds of heinous crimes. But in the past, these women were often hard for the public to understand. The press, often aided by clever defense attorneys, could spin the story of a cold-blooded female killer into a pitiful tale of a hapless woman manipulated by a powerful man. In today's episode about a double murder in the early 1980s, Cindy Campbell Ray's story could have gone both ways. She did have the help of a man, an ex-Marine named David West. But deciding which one of them held the puppet strings would ultimately be up to a jury. Was Cindy a victim too, threatened by her violent boyfriend? Or was she the puppet master? In a twist the press would love, the killer couple was brought down by another woman. She was the young, sexy, and smart heroine the public needed. And forgotten in this salacious intrigue was the innocent couple, grandparents, brutally murdered in the same room that Cindy's sons were sleeping in. Welcome to episode 147, The Murders of James and Virginia Campbell. In the 1950s, Houston, Texas construction workers broke ground on developing the land between Buffalo Bayou and the I-10. The area was to become Memorial, a neighborhood where the rich could build or purchase opulent, extravagant new homes or estates. Because Memorial offered residents the beautiful sights of luscious forests while still maintaining a city feel, it soon became one of Houston's most prestigious neighborhoods. Memorial grew quickly in size as wealthy Houstonians like James and Virginia Campbell flocked to the area. Married in 1949, the Campbells ran a personal injury law firm together. James was the attorney, while Virginia ran everything else. She was the paralegal, the secretary, and the office manager. The Campbells had a happy and loving marriage, and according to a family friend named Irma, James, quote, must have loved her because she had some really good diamonds on her. Big rocks. Big rocks, she said. By the time the Campbells moved to Memorial, they had four daughters, Michelle, Betty, Cindy, and Jamie. Having both grown up during the Great Depression, James and Virginia made sure their girls had everything their fortune could provide. That included living in the Memorial neighborhood. In the 1960s, James and Virginia purchased a lavish 5-bedroom, 3-bath house outfitted with a massive library for all of the couple's law books. In the garage, the Campbells set up a soda fountain for the girls, and they had an apartment over the garage for their longtime live-in maid, Maria Gonzalez. As they grew older, three of the Campbell daughters had no problem fitting into Houston society. But Cindy, the third born, was a different story. Born in 1955, Cynthia Campbell, who always went by Cindy, had been a talented artist. But to friends and family of James and Virginia, Cindy stood out as odd in comparison to the other popular Campbell girls. According to the Los Angeles Times, Cindy's friends said she mimicked the look of Kate Jackson from Charlie's Angels. She styled her hair after the Angels Sabrina and wore similar clothes. She also deliberately affected a stilted accent that she said was based on Vivien Leigh's character, Blanche DuBois, in the movie A Streetcar Named Desire. This sounds innocent enough, a young woman trying to find out who she wanted to be, but she had a very dark side. One Houston detective told the TV show Snapped that Cindy was the black sheep of a family in which the other three sisters were all very close to each other and their parents. According to a childhood friend named Vicky, Cindy rarely talked about her siblings, but when she did, she dramatically said her older sisters hated her guts and that her younger sister was a tattletale. By the time Cindy was a student at Memorial High School, she was always telling Vicky that she wanted to run away. And in 1972, that's exactly what she did. After saving up some money, 17-year-old Cindy ran off to Colorado, where she soon met and started dating a 22-year-old man named Michael Charles Ray. The new couple soon traveled to the East Coast. During their cross-country trip, Cindy got pregnant with her first son. So on July 23, 1973, Cindy and Michael married in Covington, Virginia. A few years later, Cindy, Michael, and their toddler moved to Houston, where Cindy would later give birth to her second and final child, another son. A family friend named Irma told Snapped that Cindy moved back to Houston because she no longer wanted to be married to Michael. And more importantly, Cindy would get help raising her sons if she was closer to her parents. By 1976, Cindy and Michael officially separated after Cindy asked her dad to help her with the divorce. By the time James Campbell was done, Michael had lost custody of his children. Though it's debatable how hard Michael fought James, since, as Irma put it, he didn't have to pay child support. She didn't need child support. She had a rich daddy. With Michael out of the picture, Cindy wanted a fresh start. James and Virginia let her move into an apartment building they owned, and Cindy enrolled at a local college her younger sister Jamie was attending, much to Jamie's chagrin. And Cindy didn't work, so James and Virginia paid all the bills, along with providing her a rent-free apartment. Even though Cindy had won custody, it would seem she just wanted her ex-husband out of her life. She didn't really want to be a mother. So James and Virginia started raising their two grandsons, and were later awarded custody following an uncontested civil action. Now Cindy was kid-free, living in a rent-free apartment, with Mama and Daddy paying for everything. Soon she met a 24-year-old former Marine named David West, who had been described as a macho boy. It was kind of a put-on macho act, if anything. He had a pit bull he liked to try and scare people with, and he worked out incessantly. A couple of years younger than Cindy, David had originally dated the youngest Campbell daughter, Jamie, but she dumped him, calling him a wimp. Like Cindy, David Duval West was from an old, wealthy Houston family. According to an author he later worked with, he wasn't just close to his mother. He was the veritable mama's boy to socialite Cecilia West. He found his father, Duval West, to be distant and cold, but his mother, described as a dramatic woman, who ironically put on a fake accent like Cindy did, he adored. David put his mother, Cecilia, on a pedestal, and he always needed her approval. One of David's friends, Chuck, told Snapped, he was a loud, boisterous guy. He had that confidence and a little bit of cockiness. Despite that, David was supposedly a likable guy. He had many friends, though they often took advantage of him. He owned an old duplex and rarely collected rent from the friends he let stay there. His relationship with Cindy blossomed for any number of reasons, but not the least of which was because he finally got his mother to like her. And more than that, Cecilia began to feel sorry for Cindy. By the early 1980s, James Campbell was starting to think about retiring. He was 55 and had been working for nearly 40 years. He wanted to spend more time with Virginia and their two grandsons. There was only one issue, Cindy. She had stopped going to college and she was not working, which meant she relied solely on her parents to support her financially. James and Virginia were getting tired of their third-born's laziness, and they began to let Cindy know it. It was time to grow up and take responsibility at least for her own damn self, if not her kids. The relationship Cindy had with her parents was growing even more strained. Soon, she had moved in with her boyfriend. In the sweltering early morning hours of June 19, 1982, the Campbell's live-in maid, Maria Gonzalez, heard a noise coming from James and Virginia's bedroom. But when she looked out the window towards their room, she didn't see anything, so she went back to bed. It was about 4:40 a.m. About 5 minutes later, Maria heard banging on her door. She opened the door to James and Virginia's two grandsons, who told her something was wrong. The little boys said their grandparents had red on them. After calling 911, Maria tried to phone the boy's mother, Cindy, but she didn't answer. So she called James's brother, JW, who thankfully picked up the phone and said he would be right over. Police arrived and made their way to the couple's bedroom. Just 5 or 6 feet inside the door sat the bed, where 55-year-old James and 55-year-old Virginia both lay dead from 3 gunshot wounds each, 2 in the head and 1 to the chest, execution style. It was the first murder in the Memorial neighborhood anyone could remember. It would have been shocking and horrific, even if two little boys had not been in the same room when it happened. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. After first speaking with Maria, officers spoke to James and Virginia's two grandsons, who were only 7 and 8 years old. When asked if they had seen anything, the older boy told the officer, "I have the right to remain silent." Knowing the boys were being raised by an attorney, officers decided to bring in some family members to talk with them. When the boys felt comfortable, they said they had been camping out in sleeping bags at the foot of their grandparents' bed, like they did every Friday night, when they heard the shots. The terrified little boys had hidden in their bags for a while before running to Maria's apartment. After it was clear the boys hadn't seen anything that would help the police, officers worked on getting a hold of Cindy, their mother. When she still couldn't be reached, J.W. Campbell, James's brother, said he would take care of the boys and finally got them out of that house. Investigators went back to the crime scene to see what they could find. During a perimeter search, they found that a window in the living room was unlocked and open. As they continued looking, they came to the front door, which was also open, and inside the door lay one latex glove. At the foot of James and Virginia's bed was a huge pile of sleeping bags, blankets, and pillows. That's where the boys had been sleeping when the killer entered the bedroom. The pile was so thick that it concealed the boys. It seemed likely that the killer may not have even known they were there. But one thing was clear. The killer had to walk up next to, or possibly even step over, that pile to shoot the couple. There were .45-caliber shell casings scattered nearby. The whole house was completely in order. There were no open drawers or any items that were missing or had been moved. And furthermore, Virginia was found with her big, big diamonds still on. It was obvious the motive for the murders hadn't been robbery. Detectives felt it could have been some sort of grudge. One prosecutor later told Snapped, "Two people executed in their bed and there's nothing taken? That's not a burglary. That's not a robbery. That's a hit." And more than just a hit. It appeared to be a revenge-type murder. Officers started going over the possibility that one of James's clients could be the one with a grudge. But after doing some digging, it no longer seemed like a valid theory. According to a friend of James Campbell, who was also an attorney, James didn't have any criminal clients. He was a nice guy and an excellent lawyer who took care of his personal injury clients. It was very unlikely any of them would be out to get him. Another issue with a client with a grudge theory was that the killer clearly knew the layout of the Campbell home. They had entered through an open window, walked directly up the stairs to the bedroom, fired the shots, and left through the front door. It is doubtful any clients would have ever been over to the Campbell home. Meanwhile, as CSI dusted the window for fingerprints, they did notice a boot print in the flower bed below. Because the boot was large, investigators now believed they were looking for at least one male assailant. With the robbery and client grudge motives marked off their list, investigators went back to the Campbell's maid, Maria, to see if she had any further information for them, especially about anyone who might want the Campbells dead. Maria told them that the two boys' parents, Cindy and Michael, had been divorced for around 6 years, when the boys were still babies. After Cindy moved back to Houston, she was rarely around, and her parents began raising her sons and were soon awarded custody. And the Campbells had adored their grandsons. Virginia had apparently been worried that one day, Michael would just up and decide that he wanted his children back. Whatever Virginia really knew about Michael Ray is a mystery, but she told Maria that she wanted the doors and windows kept locked. Maria also told investigators that she had recently found empty beer cans and cigarette butts in the garden, leading them to theorize someone had been staking out the Campbells' place. Next, investigators decided to talk to the four Campbell daughters in hopes of finding out some more information about Michael Ray, angry clients, or anyone else who might want to kill their parents. In the morning hours following the murders, all of the daughters, except Cindy, showed up at the station. Investigators thought it was odd that Cindy couldn't make it. She was the only daughter who actually lived in town. But they continued on with the interviews. The other three daughters told investigators that they couldn't think of anything out of the ordinary. They'd all spoken with their parents in the days leading up to their deaths, and everything seemed fine. As detectives moved the interviews along, they were interrupted when an officer came to tell them that Cindy Campbell Ray and her boyfriend, David West, had just shown up. After they joined everyone in the room, investigators asked Cindy about her ex-husband, Michael. They had found out he had a criminal history. Could he be responsible? Cindy confirmed that Michael Ray had a past, including a robbery conviction in Kansas, but she said she did not know where he lived or how to contact him. The Houston detectives wrapped up the interviews, not learning much else of importance. However, before allowing Cindy and David to leave, investigators split them up and took their statements about where they had been during the murders. Cindy said she had seen her parents that night. She had gone to their house around 10 p.m., needing to borrow some money, naturally. Following that, she was with David for the whole night. They attended a party, then went back to their apartment before going to another party at around 3 a.m. David's story was pretty much identical to Cindy's. Investigators now wanted to verify everyone's alibis. Because Cindy and David were the only ones who lived in town, their alibis were looked into first. James and Virginia were laid to rest on June 22nd. Numerous investigators went to pay their respects, as well as keep an eye on mourners, as detectives often do in a murder case. But they were surprised to find out that all four Campbell girls were late to their parents' funeral. Investigators soon found out why. Michelle told them that she and her sisters, Betty and Jamie, had caught Cindy rifling through their mother's things. When they asked what she was doing, Cindy said she was looking for Virginia's diamonds, but she couldn't find them. Detectives asked Michelle to come in and talk to them some more about her sister Cindy. Michelle told the officers that finding Cindy going through their mother's items on the day of her funeral wasn't surprising or shocking. In fact, it was pretty typical for her. Cindy had an adversarial relationship with both parents, she said, and she was always wanting something. And she had pretty much always gotten what she wanted until recently, when their father decided to cut her off completely. This is why she had moved in with her boyfriend, David West. They had done enough for her. Not only were they raising her children, but they had given her a place to live, paid for the college classes that she stopped going to, gave her money whenever she needed it, and much more. It would seem they never said no to their spoiled daughter. But Cindy had never appreciated anything and had grown far too dependent on her parents. And now it had finally been enough. It was time for her to get a job and support herself, if not her own kids. Michelle told investigators that Cindy wanted to get her inheritance as soon as possible. So following their parents' funeral, she started aggressively filing lawsuits to obtain her part of the estimated $2 million estate. Investigators now realized the motive probably was money, but the killer was not from one of the Campbells' clients, but possibly their own daughter. Although, I do think it's fair to say the grudge motive also applied. Cindy Ray seemed to detest her parents. But Houston police didn't have enough evidence for an arrest, so they had to keep digging. Around a week after the murders, investigators received the forensic test reports and were disappointed to find that there was nothing physically linking Cindy to the crime. Regardless, she remained their number one suspect. Then Jamie, the youngest Campbell daughter, went to the police. She also had a bombshell to drop. This one was even bigger than Michelle's. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from today's sponsors. My job is incredibly rewarding, but also comes with a lot of pressure to perform. When it's time for some fun, I try to remember I've earned it, and so should you. Taking time out to play Best Fiends is like giving yourself permission to eat dessert first. I play with my stepdaughter, which is a fun way to stay connected, and we are neck and neck at about level 3800. Best Fiends is a free-to-download mobile puzzle game with thousands of exciting levels for new adventures and challenges every time you play. Brand new events and challenges pop up all year round, so you've always got a chance to earn exclusive in-game items, characters, and rewards. Right now, there is a season of festivals to go through for new rewards, and another challenge that when you complete tasks, you get a bat to break piñatas. With offline play, you'll never be stranded without fun, even if you lose your internet connection. You've earned your fun time. Go to the App Store or Google Play to download Best Fiends for free. Plus, earn more with $5 worth of in-game rewards when you reach level 5. That's Friends Without the R, Best Fiends. Today's episode is brought to you by BetterHelp Online Therapy. You will probably drop anything to help someone you care about. Why is it we go out of our way to show up for others, but often ignore our own needs? So this month, BetterHelp Online Therapy wants to remind you that you matter just as much as everyone else does, and therapy is a great way to make sure you show up for yourself. I consider therapy an integral part of my overall wellness, but I have a crazy schedule, and I'm always on deadline. BetterHelp makes it so easy to stay in touch with myself and my needs. BetterHelp is online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. Give it a try and see why over 2 million people have used BetterHelp Online Therapy. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Southern Fried True Crime listeners get 10% off their first month at BetterHelp.com/Southern. That's BetterHelp.com/Southern. Jamie told investigators that around 2 years ago, after Cindy and their parents got into an argument about something, Cindy told Jamie, "We'd be better off without Daddy, because then all the girls could have whatever they wanted." Cindy went on to say that she would make their dad's murder look like a man had done it by using gloves and maybe a ski mask, wearing heavy boots or shoes, and leaving behind Marlboro cigarettes while walking around a window. The detectives were skeptical. Why had Jamie waited so long to say something? Was this just more family drama? Though Cindy was already a suspect, the timing of Jamie's revelation was weird. Investigators brought Cindy back in so they could question her about this bizarre story. But now, Cindy told them she'd hired an attorney who advised her not to speak with law enforcement. Of course, everyone has the right to an attorney, and hiring one is certainly not a sign of guilt. But come on, this obviously only made Cindy even more suspicious to detectives who had already been investigating her, though they weren't having much luck. In their investigation, they did eventually track down Cindy's ex-husband, Michael Ray. Michael told them he was in Colorado when the murders occurred, and his alibi checked out. And that left only one name on the suspect list, the one that had always been there, Cindy Campbell Ray. Investigators spoke to the Campbell's maid, Maria, again. She told them that 9 days prior to the murders, she was walking around the back of the home, raising and lowering window blinds, when she caught Cindy trying to sneak in through a window. After she confronted Cindy, who Maria described as excited and nervous, Maria walked around making sure all the windows were locked. She continued doing that every day up until the night of the murder. When detectives showed Maria which window the killer had entered through, She noticed it was the same one she had caught Cindy sneaking through just 9 days before. Remember, Cindy had told the police she had gone to her parents' house at around 10 p.m. on the night of the murders to borrow some money. Investigators theorized that Cindy, while her mom went upstairs to get the money, had unlocked the window so she could sneak back in later to kill her parents. Still, none of the information detectives had gathered was enough for a conviction. The case was pretty much at a dead end. In late 1984, more than 2 years after the murder, James and Virginia's estate was about to be settled. Cindy Campbell Ray had already received about $58,000 in cash and a small apartment complex with 4 units. The other 3 Campbell sisters were convinced that Cindy had killed their parents, and they couldn't wait any longer for authorities to make an arrest, so they hired famed Houston private investigator Clyde Wilson. Clyde and his team investigated the double murder and came to the same conclusion as the authorities. Cindy had the only motive and was the only suspect. And just like the authorities, Clyde wasn't able to find enough evidence. That's when one of Clyde's employees suggested that he send in 23-year-old Kim Paris undercover to gain Cindy's boyfriend's trust. The employee felt like Kim was the perfect person for the job. People magazine described Kim Paris as tall and shapely, endowed with a come-hither voice. She had dark hair and blue eyes. Many described her as looking like Deborah Winger, an actress known for her roles in An Officer and a Gentleman, as well as Urban Cowboy in Terms of Endearment, two of my personal favorites. Based on her looks alone, Kim was the perfect woman for the job, but many of the other investigators were skeptical. Having been working for the agency for less than 3 months, they didn't think she had enough experience to go undercover. But on the other hand, it wasn't like Kim was some fragile doll who would crack under pressure. Until the year prior, she had been a Navy flight controller until 1983. After an honorable discharge from the military, Kim moved to Houston with the idea of getting a job as a civilian flight controller. But then, 2 months before the Campbell daughters sought out a private investigator, Kim took a position at Clyde Wilson's agency. Clyde was also skeptical about Kim's ability to go undercover so quickly, but decided to take a chance on the attractive young woman. For this assignment, Kim's looks were definitely an asset they could use. She was sexy and exuded confidence. Kim's first order of business was to talk to investigator Denise Mosley, who had become the resident expert in all things David West. Denise told Kim that David was currently working as a delivery boy for a blueprint company. She warned Kim that he considered himself to be a survivalist. He collected guns, read Soldier of Fortune magazine, and lifted weights at the gym every day. And most importantly, he was also now single. He and Cindy had recently broken up. Denise told Kim that David was living in Montrose, an area People magazine described in a quote that has not aged well as being a part of town where gentrified homes butted up against strip joints and gay bars, where artists and weirdos, illegal aliens, and prostitutes breathed the same air. Denise told Kim that everyone in Montrose has a gimmick. Kim would be an unemployed punk rocker, which meant sporting spiky pink hair, leotards, black fishnet stockings, and spiked heels. Kim, eager to go undercover, was totally fine with the makeover and her assumed persona as a hot punk rock girl. Kim was allowed to choose her own alias, and she chose Teresa Neal, the name Agatha Christie used when she disappeared in 1926, which makes me love the smart and gutsy Kim Paris all the more. And finally, Kim had to come up with a ruse to meet her mark. She would knock on David's door and ask for a non-existent dude named Charlie. When David or his roommate said it was the wrong house, she would ask if she could come in to use the phone. Once inside, she planned to start flirting with David, which would most likely lead to a date. She was a stunning woman, after all. Just before Christmas 1984, on December 19th, Kim knocked on David's door, but David didn't answer. His roommate did. Kim did stick to her ruse, and after the roommate said she had the wrong place, Kim acted all embarrassed, saying, "My sister sent me here to pick up something, and I know she gave me the right address. Do you mind if I come inside and use the phone?" He invited her inside, and Kim soon realized David wasn't home, so she struck up a conversation with the roommate. She later told people, "I went in there and was Chatty Cathy, but basically myself. It worked." David's clueless buddy asked Kim to go with him to meet some friends, including his roommate, for drinks. At the bar, Kim quickly deduced which friend was David, then pulled up a chair next to him and started talking. She later told People magazine, "I just asked him things you would ask anyone you've just met, like, what do you do? Where are you from? Regular stuff. It's surprisingly easy to get close to people. One minute I'm a stranger, the next I'm their best friend." During their conversation, David told Kim that he wanted to open a bar, like the one they were in. Kim said, "That's cool, but opening a bar costs a lot of money. How can you afford it?" David said his ex-girlfriend Cindy was about to come into some money, and she had agreed to be his silent partner. This little tidbit was exactly what Kim was looking for. Following their night out at the bar, Kim and David continued hanging out, seeing each other 3 to 4 nights a week and talking on the phone almost every day. Kim later said she was always in control of her relationship with David. She was the one who called him. He never called her. She was the one who set up dates, not him. And she always wore sneakers and insisted on driving when they were together. She didn't bring a weapon with her, feeling safe because there was usually another agent following them, but it didn't hurt to wear running shoes just in case. Because she just wanted close to David, but obviously not close enough to have sex with him, Kim set up boundaries at the very beginning. They could have a close, dating-type relationship, but there would be zero physical stuff. Luckily for Kim, she found that it was pretty easy to dance around the subject of sex with David. She told People, "David was interested in deeper things. He loved to talk. We both liked history, and we liked to read, so we had a lot to talk about. David loved to argue about religion and politics and philosophy. We spent most of our time together in conversation, not something too many people do nowadays." During their time together, Kim told David that she was only interested in dating macho men, hoping to manipulate him into trying to impress her by telling her about crimes he had committed. This tactic worked. He eventually started hinting that he had done a terrible thing, but never elaborated, acting all mysterious. However, David would often talk about his ex-girlfriend Cindy and how her parents were killed tragically in a car accident. Kim later told the paper UPI, "That struck me as unusual. If he didn't have anything to do with their deaths, it would be human nature to say, 'You'll never guess how they were killed. They were murdered in their sleep.'" By late January 1985, David had given Kim a studded black leather bracelet and told her he wanted to marry her. She then went to her boss, Clyde Wilson, and explained that David was talking about marriage. She felt that it was time for the next step. She would tell David that she knew he was hiding something and she couldn't marry him if he didn't come clean about this terrible thing he had done. With a confession probably nearing, Clyde and Kim went to visit Clyde's friend and Houston Police Sergeant, J.C. Mosier. He asked Kim if she would be willing to wear a wire, and she said yes. On February 20th, Kim wore a hidden microphone to dinner with David, with the transmitter hidden in her purse. Detectives sat nearby in an unmarked van, listening to everything Kim and David talked about. After they finished eating, the pair drove to David's place, where they sat in the driveway talking. That's where Kim told David that if he didn't tell her what he was hiding, she would leave him. He immediately told her, "Look at me. I killed both of Cindy's parents. There. Now do you know I trust you?" Interestingly, Kim had actually thought David was all talk. She later told the TV show Snapped, "Never ever until the moment he told me did I think that he did it." When he was done with his story, David told Kim, "You now have my life in your hands," thinking, "You have no idea." Kim told him to go upstairs and get some sleep. She would call him in the morning. The needy David asked, "You promise?" And she replied, "Yes." Kim drove away, but didn't make it very far before she had to pull over, get out of her car, run to a nearby yard, and she vomited. When she got home, detectives were there waiting. It was time to come up with a new game plan. Now that investigators knew Cindy hadn't actually been the killer, they needed Kim to wear a wire one more time. They needed to know why David had killed the Campbells and what Cindy's role was, so they could finally get an indictment on her. Kim later told Snapped that she did not feel comfortable seeing David again. She said she couldn't explain it, but she didn't want to hurt David, who she saw as fragile. She later told the Washington Post, quote, "This whole thing was very emotional for me. You can't be involved with someone for 2.5 months, under the circumstances that I was, without there being real ties. I spent 2.5 months inside his head." After Kim expressed her discomfort, investigators left her with a manila envelope and told her to check out the contents and then get back to them. After they left, Kim opened the envelope and found color photographs of the crime scene. Seeing what David had done to James and Virginia Campbell changed everything for her. She was ready to go back in. The next day, the DA's office held a secret grand jury hearing, which resulted in David West being indicted on 2 counts of capital murder. Meanwhile, detectives met with Kim to come up with their final plans. That evening, she would go to dinner with David again, this time focusing on getting him to tell her as much as possible. When they were done eating, she would stop at a convenience store. While she went in to buy cigarettes, police would come out and arrest David. Later that evening, dinner went as planned, with David telling Kim everything. It was like he was finally relieved to talk about what he had been keeping secret for so long. David said that Cindy had told him she was physically and sexually abused by her dad throughout her adolescence. He said her firstborn son was actually the result of her father raping her. Cindy also said that her mother often locked her in closets for hours at a time when she was a child. Prior to the murders, Cindy's father had supposedly started abusing her again. Cindy said she couldn't take it, so she begged David to kill her parents, and she offered him money. But he said he didn't want it because, quote, "That would change everything. I didn't do it for the money." He said he did it because he felt like he needed to save her from her terrible parents. David continued, telling Kim how the murders were committed. Earlier that evening, Cindy had unlocked the downstairs window so they could get in the house without making noise. Later, when they went to the house, Cindy dressed in a hat, raincoat, and boots that were too big. She wanted to look like a man in case anybody woke up and saw her. Before they went in through the window, she purposely left a footprint in the flower bed in hopes of making investigators believe a man was the assailant. It had initially worked. After sneaking in, Cindy and David walked carefully up the stairs to James and Virginia's bedroom. They opened the bedroom door, turned on the light, and David walked to the foot of the bed, making sure not to step on the children who were sleeping there. Cindy fled the room as David shot both her parents once, before shooting them each in the head 2 times, execution style, making sure they were dead. David continued his confession, telling Kim that Cindy became slightly unhinged following the murders. He began to worry she was going to tell someone what happened, so he had thought about killing Cindy too, but decided against it. Then, David told Kim he would never be taken alive. He lifted up his pant leg and showed her a gun he had strapped to his leg. On their way home from dinner, Kim stopped at the convenience store as planned. She went inside to buy cigarettes, and by the time she came out, David had been arrested. Kim told Snapped that as she stood next to the police, quote, "I could see it come over his face when he realized who I was or what I was. I remember clearly the thought I had. It was, don't look down. You have to look him in the eye and own this." As David was taken to the station, officers went to arrest Cindy on a probable cause warrant. Detective Carl Kent told Snapped that when he walked her into the station, he purposefully took her by the room with David so she could see that he was talking to investigators. Once Kent got Cindy into the room, she refused to tell him anything, so she was taken to a cell, and the next day, she was charged with 2 counts of capital murder. Cindy had no idea that David had also refused to confess to the police, or that he had been charged with 2 counts of capital murder, meaning he could face the death penalty. The main issue leading up to David's trial was the confession he made to Kim. It was unclear if the tapes would be admissible as evidence. The prosecution was uneasy because the confession was their main piece of evidence. Meanwhile, with Cindy in jail, her 3 sisters and Uncle J.W., who now had full custody of her sons, sued Cindy in order to recover the apartment building and the $58,000 in cash she was awarded from the estate. The family's attorney told the Associated Press, quote, "The law doesn't allow her to profit from her wrongdoing, and basically, we're alleging that she has profited from her wrongdoing by inheriting some of her parents' assets." However, within a few months, the family did drop the lawsuit because they felt it might interfere with the criminal case. On March 14th, a grand jury refused to indict Cindy Ray, and she was released from jail. The prosecution said they were not surprised. They could still file charges against her in the future. The issue is based on Texas law. Cindy couldn't be charged with murder as an accomplice solely based on David's confession or testimony. There had to be additional evidence pointing to their guilt together, and it appeared that the grand jury didn't think the prosecution had anything more than David's confession when it came to proving Cindy's guilt. However, the prosecution kept trying for an indictment, and on December 10, 1985, they finally got one. Cindy Campbell Ray was indicted for non-capital murder, conspiracy to commit capital murder, and solicitation of capital murder for her father. For some reason, the grand jury did not indict Cindy for her mother's murder. The prosecution told the Associated Press that they did not charge Cindy with capital murder because they didn't feel it would, quote, "be proper and realistic for us to seek the death penalty against the non-trigger man with the testimony of the trigger man." On December 11, 1985, right before 29-year-old David's trial was about to start, Judge A.D. Azios ruled that Kim Paris's confession tape could be admitted as evidence. David realized he was in serious trouble, so he took a plea deal. In exchange for pleading guilty to the non-capital murder of Virginia, David was sentenced to life in prison with a possibility of parole after 20 years. As part of the deal, he would have to testify against Cindy at her trial. After Cindy's trial, David would then plead guilty to the murder of James and receive the same sentence. If he did not hold up his end of the bargain, then the prosecution held the right to upgrade David's charges to capital murder, which meant he would face the death penalty again. When David signed his plea agreement, he wrote, "I committed the above murder along with and with the aid of Cynthia Campbell Ray." I'm going to pause now to hear a final word from today's sponsors. What do U.S. News, PC Magazine, and Popular Science have in common? They all ranked Simply Safe Home Security as the best home security of 2021. U.S. News has already named Simply Safe the best home security of 2022. I work from home, which means I'm alone a lot, and having cameras at my fingertips gives me a great peace of mind. Simply Safe protects your whole home around the clock, every door, window, and room. It's backed by the best 24/7 professional monitoring in the business, ready to dispatch police, firefighters, or EMTs to your home. With a comprehensive set of sensors and cameras, including the all-new wireless outdoor security camera, you always know what's going on inside and outside of your home. Simply Safe is less than $1 a day, and you can set it up in around 30 minutes, and it's always simple to use. There's never a long-term contract. You can even try it for 60 days risk-free to see if you like it. If you don't, send it back free of charge. Simply Safe protects impacts over a million homes in the United States alone. You can customize the perfect system for your home in just a few minutes at simplysafe.com/southernfried. Go today and claim a free indoor security camera plus 20% off with interactive monitoring. Go to simplysafe.com/southernfried. Thrive Cosmetics are high-performance beauty and skincare products made with clean ingredients. I love how easily Thrive fits into my daily routine, from their skincare to their makeup. Thrive makes me feel beautiful without any hassle. Their Overnight Sensation Brightening Sleep Mask restores, hydrates, and rejuvenates my skin with just one night's sleep. And as I've told you, I use the Brilliant Eye Brightener daily. The cream-to-powder highlighter is so much easier to apply than conventional eyeshadow. And the best part is Thrive's bigger than beauty mission. For every product purchased, Thrive Cosmetics donates to causes that help women thrive, like women who have been unhoused. This is where the cause in Thrive Cosmetics comes from. Now is a great time to try Thrive Cosmetics for yourself. Right now, you can get 15% off your first order when you visit thrivecosmetics.com/southernfried. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS.com/southernfried for 15% off your first order. On April 4th, 1986, nearly 4 years after the murders, Cindy Ray was indicted on a non-capital murder charge for her mother's death. But on June 3rd, jury selection began and 31-year-old Cindy's trial for the murder of her father. The plan had been to try her for her mother's murder, but on June 2nd, they switched it. Both sides were okay with this decision because their evidence was the same. Again, their reasoning was not explained. The prosecution told the jury that Cindy offered to pay David West to kill her parents. Their main witness and evidence came from David, who testified for 6 days. But David's testimony alone was not enough to convict Cindy. On July 6th, Judge Azios declared a mistrial after the jury was unable to come to a decision. They had been at a 10-2 deadlock for more than 3 days, and the foreman said there was no hope for a resolution. The prosecution wasn't really surprised by the results. They had expected a mistrial and did plan to retry Cindy. On March 23, 1987, now almost 5 years after the murders, the new 32-year-old Cindy Ray went on trial for the murder of both of her parents this time. The prosecution told the jury that Cindy was mad at her parents because they were no longer going to support her financially. She did not want to grow up and get a job. So she had manipulated David West into believing she had been neglected and physically and sexually abused by her parents. But the truth is that there was absolutely no evidence that Cindy's parents were abusive. However, there was evidence of Cindy lying about abuse to other people besides David. The prosecution had several other witnesses testify that Cindy had told them stories of sexual abuse, but the person responsible varied by who she told. Sometimes she said a maid did it. Other times it was her father or her mother. After convincing David that James had started abusing her again, Cindy begged David to kill her parents, saying that if he did, she would give him money from her inheritance and would be his silent business partner. David, thinking he was going to save Cindy from her awful parents, agreed. The prosecution told the jury, not only did she persuade him to kill her parents, she persuaded him to kill her parents for something they didn't even do. Once David had agreed, Cindy helped to plan and execute the murders. She willingly went to the house, went up the stairs, and stood next to David as he shot her parents multiple times with her sons in the room. Cindy may not have pulled the trigger herself, but she was every bit as responsible as David. The defense said David was a liar. He committed the murders by himself, and Cindy had nothing to do with the plan. They claimed that David had forced Cindy to go with him to kill her parents, and that she was under duress the whole time. Part of Cindy's duress defense was based on a statement her friend Gwen Sampson had given to the police in regards to things Cindy had told her. However, at trial, she was a witness for the prosecution. So the defense had to cross-examine her about the statement she made. According to an appeal document, Gwen told police that Cindy said David, who knew the floor plan better than she did, was the one who decided to kill her parents. He was doing it to make her well. On the night of the murders, Cindy dressed like a man so her children wouldn't recognize her. She told Gwen David forced her up to her parents' bedroom and made her stand next to him. Her exact statement to the detectives had been, quote, "All I know is that she looked me straight in the eye and said, this is how it happened. I stood beside him with my children on the floor. I didn't look when he shot my father. I didn't look when he shot my mother, but I felt their body must have jumped some." Gwen went on to testify that Cindy told her while they were still in that room, David held the gun to her head and said, "If you say anything, I'll shoot you." The prosecution's rebuttal was by pointing out to the jury that the only threat Cindy detailed to Gwen was about how David threatened to kill her if she told anyone what happened. But she told Gwen David threatened her after he had shot the Campbells, meaning Cindy hadn't gone to the scene of her parents' murder with David basically holding a gun to her head. On April 14th, after deliberating for only 2 hours, the jury found Cindy guilty of the murder of both of her parents. Cindy's attorney later told the Associated Press that when she heard the verdict, she didn't say anything. She was devastated. "All I did was hold her for a while." Next up was the penalty phase. Cindy faced anywhere from between 10 years of probation and life in prison. On April 15th, after deliberating for about 3 hours, the jury recommended Cindy be sentenced to life for each murder. The Supreme Court of Texas later upheld both of her sentences. On June 5, 1987, with the completion of Cindy's trial, 31-year-old David West pled guilty to murdering James Campbell with a deadly weapon and was sentenced to life in prison, which would run concurrently with his other life sentence for murdering Virginia. David has been eligible for parole since February 2005, but is yet to be approved. His last eligibility was in April 2021, but he was denied because of the brutality of the crime. Today, 65-year-old David is incarcerated in the Ramsey Unit, a prison farm in Rocheron, Texas. He is up for parole again next month, but it's doubtful he will be released. This was a brutal execution of two grandparents. I don't think the parole board is going to give a shit that David claims he was manipulated. I could be wrong, but this is Texas we're talking about. The only reason he's not on death row is the plea deal he made. Following David's arrest, private investigator Kim Paris became a celebrity of sorts. Movie and television producers, agents, and more were trying to get a hold of her. She appeared on several TV shows like Donahue, ABC's Good Morning America, and the CBS Morning News. The Chicago Sun-Times reported, "In a nation as hungry for heroines as we are, Kim Paris not only meets, she transcends the criteria required for megastars. She is Trey gorgeous." But all of the attention turned negative when people started digging into Kim's past. It was revealed that in between leaving the Navy in 1983 and taking the job with Clyde Wilson in 1984, Kim worked as a topless dancer, struggled with drug addiction, and was arrested for driving while intoxicated, though those charges were later dismissed. By the time Cindy was convicted, Kim had moved to St. Louis, where she was from, after receiving threats and being treated so badly in the press. She temporarily left the industry and started working as a manicurist at a department store. She also got married and had a son. Kim's husband told the Dispatch, quote, "Kim and I have been through so much, and it was so unexpected. It's affected our lives in very negative ways. It reminds me of all these rape cases. The woman is put on trial. She has to go in and prove she is not the seductress." He also added, rightly, quote, "David West walked into a bedroom and blew two people away, and Kim managed to put him behind bars. This is where the story was." One Houston detective told the St. Louis Post-Dispatch that everything that came out about Kim, quote, "doesn't overshadow what she did. Had it not been for Kim Paris, this would still be an unsolved case." Harris County prosecutor Rusty Hardin agreed adding, what she did could be done only by a few people. When the admission came, she didn't do most of the talking as a police officer might. There were no leading questions. Listening to her, getting him to talk, is like listening to a real estate closing. The women jurors just loved her. When asked about Kim's past, Clyde Wilson said, "For what I hired her to do, I couldn't care less about her lifestyle. In this business, you can't hire a Baptist choir girl." Kim also had issues with two authors who wrote books about the Campbell murders. She had sold her story to Jack Olson, who wrote Cold Kill, but later had to sue him for breach of contract, though she lost that case. Then she had to deal with Clifford Irving, who published Daddy's Girl, the Campbell murder case. Clifford was infamous for being at the center of a major scandal in 1972 when it was revealed that the Howard Hughes autobiography he wrote was a complete hoax. Basically, Clifford sold the autobiography to McGraw-Hill for $650,000 after claiming that he had put together an autobiography based on 100 secret meetings. He was later sentenced to 16 months in federal prison and was on the cover of Time as the con man of the year. Clifford wrote in Daddy's Girl that when it came to the Campbell case, quote, "I started out in Houston as an observer, but I became an investigator, a friend to many of the dramatis personae, and a trial witness. As a result, to my surprise and brief discomfort, I helped to determine the outcome of events." Such bullshit. Prosecutor Rusty Hardin told the LA Times that, quote, "Irving had no impact whatsoever on the case. He shared his findings with the defense and prosecution, but he gave them little useful information. Clifford's only involvement in the case was getting called by the defense to impeach a minor prosecution witness. In fact, Clifford had actually been a nuisance." Hardin's problems with Clifford came about during trial when he had to ask the judge to ban Clifford from bringing a tape recorder into the courtroom, which was a violation of court rules. He said from there, things went steadily downhill. Hardin told the Times that Clifford is regarded by many as being, quote, "a meddlesome sleazeball, apparently unable or unwilling to let the facts stand in the way of sensationalism." I would have to agree. Not only did Clifford believe and write that James had truly fathered Cindy's eldest son, in an addendum to his book, Clifford said that after the trials, a source told him that Cindy had last-minute doubts about the killings and tried to stop David, but failed and really shouldn't be in jail. Clifford said, quote, "I believe my source, and I believe that Cindy should perhaps be in a mental institution rather than a prison. But I don't think anything's going to come of it. The Texas laws don't work that way, and the prosecutor was just too good. As a matter of fact, if I ever get into trouble again, I'd want Rusty Hardin to be my lawyer." And, as if you could not hate Clifford more, he also wrote about Kim Paris in a negative tone, saying things like, quote, "I constantly asked myself what she would have done if David West had said, okay, I'll tell you the truth, my buddy Wiki Weinstein did it. Cindy Ray put him up to it. What then about the promised love, marriage, and three children?" It was distasteful. By 1989, Kim had overcome all this adversity and was working for an investigator in St. Louis and had gone back to school. She did also help make a TV drama about the Campbell murder from her perspective. It was titled Love and Lies, and Mayor Winningham starred as Kim and Peter Gallagher as David. It came out in 1990. I am so glad Kim overcame all that bullshit. Her past as a stripper was used to shame her, which is disgraceful considering she put her life on the line to get David West to confess. As for Jack Olson's book, Cold Kill, I downloaded it to read while Haley did the research because it had high reviews. I was hoping to get a good feel for the story. I hesitate to say this about the late author, who is well respected, has won many awards, and I'm sure many of you might be fans. But that book is fictionalized. It reads like a crime thriller, which is fine, but not for my purposes. I quit about a quarter of the way through and skimmed the rest because there is no real way to cite a book like that as a source. But it's clear Olson mainly had access to David West and maybe his mother. The reason I'm telling you about it is because, in my opinion, he is awfully sympathetic to a cold-blooded double murderer. He paints David as some naive Svengali. The book reads that David meets the shy and pudgy Cindy Ray, whom he is not attracted to, but feels sorry for. He puts her on a strict diet and exercise program, and as she blossoms into the beautiful woman he wants, they begin a sexual relationship, which of course Olson details rather salaciously. In the book, once they begin their relationship, Cindy supposedly wears David and his mother down with tales of horrific abuse. But here's the truth. David West was also a lazy ass from an old, wealthy Houston family. His parents were Duval and Cecilia West, both from prominent families. And though it seems he was a mama's boy, Duval didn't think much of his son because David lacked ambition and made nothing of himself. David owned a shitty duplex he bought with an inheritance from an aunt and claims that he offered the pitiful Cindy Ray a free place to stay after she left her college. But he rarely worked, or worked hard at any rate. I think it's just as easy to assume that David West was willing to kill Cindy's parents for the money. He's no saint, but he is portrayed in Cold Kill as this kind of silly, chivalrous man, easily taken in by women. I guess the point being that he was an easy mark for Kim Paris. And Olson never actually gets into the trial, much less Cindy's side of the story for that matter. Anyway, my apologies if you are a fan, but I like to be honest about these things. That's not true crime, in my opinion. Not when you are fictionalizing entire scenes and dialogue, based on one person's report. While in prison, Cindy Campbell Ray applied for parole at least 3 times, all of which were denied. On May 17, 2021, while incarcerated in the Carol Young Medical Facility in Dickinson, Texas, 65-year-old Cynthia Helen Cindy Campbell Ray died from complications of numerous health conditions after a 6-month hospital stay. Cindy had gained weight before her trial, and then her weight had ballooned in prison, not uncommon with the starchy menus they serve, especially for people prone to gain weight. And her obesity was a contributing factor to her many health issues. Some shows and many blogs and articles ridicule her appearance, wondering how she had ever seduced David. But contemporary photos of Cindy show she was indeed an attractive woman. I think she did manipulate David, but I also do not believe he murdered her parents out of chivalry for the allegations of sexual abuse. He did it for the money. You know, it can be for both reasons, but I'm not sure David's sense of chivalry would have gone that far without financial incentive. Frankly, chivalry is a fairly ridiculous motive when you consider this man shot 2 people several times with small children in the room. What kind of supposed hero murders an elderly couple in cold blood in front of their grandchildren? I will say that the portrayal of Cindy as a psychopath or a sociopath by many in the press or authors or in documentaries may not be far off from the mark. There has never been any proof of her allegations of abuse. What there is proof of is that Cindy Campbell Ray was a spoiled, entitled, lazy, and spiteful woman. She wanted an easy life, without kids, parents, or men to bother her. It's telling that she never attempted to regain custody of her children after her parents' murders. She didn't want those boys. She didn't love her parents. She just wanted money. James and Virginia Campbell were good people. They had survived the Great Depression and then worked hard to provide for their family as well as gain a foothold in Houston society. In their 50s, they were beginning their golden years, apparently more than happy to raise their young grandsons. They just wanted to retire, live peacefully, and dote on their other daughters and grandchildren. David West and Cindy Ray brutally murdered this lovely couple. Now the other Campbell sisters, their children, and most tragically, Cindy's children, were robbed of the loving James and Virginia. Cindy's boys already had a rough start to life with two indifferent parents, and now they had to survive the horror of witnessing their grandparents' murders. All because the selfish, spoiled Cindy had finally been told to grow up. Southern Fried True Crime is hosted and produced by me, Erica Kelly. Today's episode was researched and written by Haley Gray, with additional writing by me and research assistance by Anna Luria. Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio, and the original graphic art is by Coley Horner. If you have any case suggestions, please visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com, and go to the Listener Suggestion tab. And if you have submitted a case suggestion in the last few months, please resubmit it on the website. I was very overwhelmed by email when I came back from sick leave, and I never caught up. This is the best way for me to get to those little-known cases y'all always send me. Please remember that I do not accept suggestions on social media private messaging. With three platforms to manage, that is also very overwhelming for me, so I hope you understand. But please come join our Facebook group, Southern Fried True Crime Fans Discussion Group, where we swap recipes, worship Dolly Parton, and share memes. I much prefer spending my social media time in our lovely group. We do, of course, discuss true crime, not just Southern Fried, but all kinds, but it is still very much a Southern lifestyle group. Our group is a safe and fun corner of Facebook, and by God, we mean it when we say no shit ass is allowed. It's not just a motto, it's how we run the group. If you enjoyed today's show, please don't forget to subscribe and tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on all large platforms like iHeart, Stitcher, and Spotify. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.